Good evening and welcome to Editing Aloud. So there I am minding my own business last night at 10 p.m. watching the television screen, and onto it comes our president, Cyril Ramaphosa, to brief us on the outcome of the ANC's Lekgotla. Number one, the ANC has made a decision about what it's going to do about the constitution and land expropriation without compensation. And number two, the ANC has promised us an economic stimulus package, which is going to help us with the terrible unemployment figures that came out this week. The land thing, Sikonathi, is this a positive signal or a negative signal? Certainly the RAND took it as a very negative signal.
It's a totally opportunistic and populist response to the EFF, trying to pull the carpet right under its feet. And unfortunately, there will always be a price to pay for that. Let's wait and see. The most interesting thing is not even Ramaphosa yesterday could say what this change will be in the Constitution. Exactly. So again, we have to wait. What do you call it in the market when you keep everything hanging and waiting?
Policy
and
uncertainty, as we say.
Policy uncertainty, yeah. And let people speculate. And there we go. Together about the package as well that he spoke of.
There's the stimulus package.
There's absolutely no package. It was just trying to camouflage the mess that they were about to unleash on the market.
Let's come back to that one. But Ray, I mean, the reason I'm asking whether it's positive is that if you listen to the statement, at some point he said what amendments to the Constitution the ANC actually had in mind was to define the conditions under which land could be expropriated without compensation. Now, nobody seems to have taken a lot of notice of that. Now, is that progress? Is that an upside, or is that actually just making things worse?
I think that it's not possible for the ANC to not amend the Constitution now, especially in light of the months of public hearings where person after person after person has stood up and supported the constitutional amendment against a minority of people who have spoken against it. So they unleashed that process. And, you know, they started the fire. The fire is raging. Now you've got to deal with it. So what was interesting is that there was a planned press briefing on the Lekgotla for this morning. But Ramaphosa chose to go on television last night and very clearly, in a recorded message, mind you, read from the script exactly what's what.
And what do you make of that late night intervention?
Well, you know, I mean, all the little ones are in bed, so you can't frighten them too much. No, I think it's, I think he wanted to be ahead of the game. I think the concern would have been, after the Lekgotla last night, there would have been leaks. Then the ANC would wake up in the morning to press reports about this thing where the message would be out of its hands. And I think they want to control the message and spell out the message. The only reason they would have done it the night before like that.
Well, so, it did still spook the markets, because the RAND had been trading at a seven-week high last night.
But you saw today is a bit of a recovery. So maybe, you know, just hearing Ray talk about this, maybe there might be some logic in this. And when you're speaking any political talk, any economic shifting talk, right? It's probably best to speak in the evening in South African context. Let the international markets take a grasp of it. Because if he announced that now, today, and came out and said that, maybe the RAND would have reacted more violently, I suppose. But today, it's already in recovery. So there may be some logic behind it. I mean, maybe there's some thought process to delivering at 10 o'clock when the markets are asleep and only people to react to it is basically Asia and so on, but even in New York and US, they're almost like going to sleep. So there may be some logic behind it. Maybe it should tell us that going forward. But you know, when they spoke about this thing, we always knew this was coming. They opened up this box. There would be a revision to the Constitution. They wouldn't come back. They couldn't go back and say, well, we thought about it, here it is, but no, we leave it as it is. There was no way they were going back when they opened up that box, right? But the key thing here is the definition, as you said, definition of defining what exactly fits into what needs to be expropriated or not. And this is where he has you have to speak about the king, the Zulu king. He's been there appeasing the king. So this defies. So also for the king, is like, okay, fine. There are particular the definition of when this will be used. And I guess in terms of food security, this is also something that have to think about. The positive is it's not. Well, what I kind of say is not all property is up for this, right? I think those are the things. So. There would have been that panic, there would have been that mess, but it's this was always coming. The minute the ANC sat down and we entertained this, they want to do this.
I think the interesting thing on the property thing is that the clause in the Constitution is not a land clause, it is a property clause, clause 25. It doesn't refer to land, it refers to property. So the question is whether this amendment would then apply to all private property, as the current clause does, or whether there would now be a subsection of the clause which deals specifically with land and therefore in brackets isolates the rest of private property from the amendment.
Sekonati, you I think are probably not as glass half full as these guys and are more likely to be a glass half empty
man. I'm quite pleased to see my colleagues celebrating.
Not celebrating.
The president of the African National Congress, who may or may not also be the president of the Republic, making these major, very important announcements when everybody is in bed. I seem to think there was a guy not so long ago called Jacob Zuma. He was fond of making these earth-shattering decisions when everybody was asleep. Mm. And on this program, on many occasions, I have likened his behavior to one Sani Abacha. I know I'm not that old to be remembering Sani Abacha alone. He was head of state in Nigeria. He worked all night and slept all day. Nigeria today has still not recovered all the money that was stolen.
However,
during
you don't want a president who works late at night.
You don't want a president that will work
before you compare him to Abacha, but the Rand, look how the Rand reacted. Like there was that reaction last night, but look at it today. That's like. Yeah. I remember Zuma having a press conference at the Union Buildings about the economy on like a normal day, 12 o'clock or something. He spoke rubbish, right? But the Rand just continually slid even further, and then there was a massive panic around. What did the president say? So if you, like, just it just makes, okay, maybe
okay, guys,
when
so
it took the eco,
whatever
maybe
later is going to talk nonsense, rubbish, confine it to the evening.
Yeah, I think so, maybe.
Yeah, like Cyril.
So that the Rand can sort of start to recover by the time the market's open in the morning.
Level of digestion of what the guy just said, right?
Well, maybe, I don't know. It's quite interesting. I mean, I think that there's definitely timing involved, because the Rand was at that seven-week high. Last night. Yeah. Okay, now we can maybe afford to smack it a bit. When it was at its weakest point, if this had happened, it might have just gone.
Just if you were worried that the currency was too strong, we can always intervene.
And while you are doing it, talking rubbish at night, smacking the rand back to where you believe it, you must commandeer the public broadcaster as well for hijack the SABC for party political purposes.
On the other hand, as you say, he is owning the narrative. Yeah. He is not leaving it to some spokesperson to go out the next morning. And maybe that's important in itself. But in some ways, the economic part of his speech, I'd have to say personally, it worried me a little bit more because it was so incredibly without content. He sort of announced that he was going to offer the ANC had decided on an economic stimulus package. Mm. And then he listed 5 points which were just...
You see, I think there is panic because yesterday's unemployment number came through, 27.7%, the highest it's been for a very long time. This is not part of the plan.
Yeah,
Ramaphosa was supposed to deliver employment.
Well, it was supposed to boost confidence, which would feed through to the economy in the country.
But all these little decisions that have been made, setting the minimum wage, labor brokers now in court, the consequences of those things have been spelled out and have been ignored, and the chickens are going to come home to roost. And so these massive job losses that we're facing, I think, is causing a bit of panic in the ANC. That is driving this land populism, and it's driving
hastily assembled. Did you look at all, Ron, at the 5-point stimulus package? I mean, is there anything there that could boost the economy?
No, there's no meeting there. Like, literally, there was just a moment of dealing with the heat of yesterday's unemployment figures. Because we all know the fiscally we're constrained. I don't know where they're going to find the space and the room to stimulate the SA economy. The only way, unless he's about to tell us there's a solution to his SOE woes, right, and freeing up their commitments to ESCOM and the like. But Again, I think that was particularly populist. That was particular. I give it to him through him. What are you doing there? But on this one, it's owning the narrative, right? And people were saying, why is he talking on SABC? I mean, that tape was given to everyone. And we'd all just want to listen to what the president's about to do about this. With the land question, such a huge question in this country, I don't know why does it matter if SABC broadcasts at 10 or not? That's another.
Speaking of fiscal issues, because the one point he did make is whatever stimulus it was going to be was going to be within the fiscal constraints. Mm. Now, on which subject, Tom Moyane Sikonathi, who's been challenging his disciplinary inquiry, this is the suspended commissioner of SARS, who is trying every which way not to be fired. We just had breaking news that the disciplinary inquiry has said all these challenges are without merit and it must go ahead. Is that good? Does it open the way for us to resolve this impasse over SARS?
I'm glad you're not asking me about Cyril's speech last night, because Ronnie has already said he was talking nonsense.
We've done Cyril's speech. We're on to Cyril's next problem, which is Cyril's next the problem. SARS commissioner.
So this, again, the ruling by Judge Rob Nugent again moves the Tom Moyane matter further.
This is the disciplinary.
Absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. So his objections to the how the commission is being run, him making a ruling there moves Moyane to the next step. Are you going to court, or are you going to sit down and we discipline you, or we inquire what's going on with the commission? So let's see what he will do, because if he seriously feels he's been aggrieved, there's so many things wrong in the law that he's been subjected to, he then can go to court and ask the court to put a stop to the inquiry until his disciplinary is completed.
I suppose the real problem with this is that SARS can't really move significantly forward until this leadership issue is
when
resolved.
When is his contract up? Isn't it soon up? He's over retirement age, right? Past it. So I guess, if anything, I also like maybe this delaying tactic that he just leaves and retires, like his contract's up, and there's no DC. Because it was extended by September.
Ray,
September?
Would you happen to remember? It was late.
He came in late 2014. Normally they have a 5-year contract. So his contract should expire in 2019. So he has a problem to sit with until
I wonder
is sorted.
If he goes to court and then his contract expires, they just fall away then. There's like a bounce. Like
in the meantime, I suppose, can you turn around revenue collection as long as
so
this thing is unresolved?
What he's trying to do now is to stop the commission's work while he deals with his disciplinary inquiry.
Yes. This is the disciplinary which is just...
So if he feels as strong as he does, saying he's been subjected to a double jeopardy, as he puts it, then he will have to go to court, and the court, he will have to show to the court why he's being served a huge injustice by being made to sit in this inquiry by SARS, or when SARS goes to dig up debt on the leadership, when he still has to defend himself as an employee of SARS. He has to do that. Otherwise, he's going to have to sit down and have the disciplinary make a decision quickly on him, and so that he can jump in and contribute to whatever implicates him as a leader of SARS when the commission...
I think we're sort of discovering that fixing governance is not as easy as we thought it was. Right. And I'm going to come back after the break to talk about the Public Investment Corporation, which this week has seen two of its board members resign, and Sikonathi possibly more board members resigning as governance there comes into question. But we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back in a few minutes. Welcome back to Editing Aloud. And Sikonathi, the Public Investment Corporation, explain to us what is going on there. The board seems to be divided. Two board members have resigned. The minister and the deputy minister seem to be at odds with each other, as far as one can see. What is the story there?
So, Nhlanhla Nene has ordered the board to conduct an inquiry, forensic inquiry, into the workings of the PIC, and that implicates the leadership of the PIC, which by extension should implicate the board itself, and he's left it up to them to decide how to proceed. He has not named the judge that will chair that inquiry. There are no terms of reference yet, but the sticking point right now at the board, do we or do we not suspend Daniel Machila and Matsepo Mora, the chief financial officer, while we are conducting this investigation, of which there are yet no terms. Of course, these people have accusations against them, including the 21 million rand allegedly to Daniel, to a person that is accused of being Daniel Machila's girlfriend, which he denies. The board then is severely divided. Others want to suspend him now, appoint then the commission. Others say, no, you can't. And the board is literally split. Tende Swafubu resigned on Monday. Before her, Claudia Manning resigned. And they, in their letters, both of them, I've seen their letters, they say they cannot work with Mondle Gungubele, the way he conducts
the deputy
himself.
Finance minister who chairs the PRC board.
Yes. They're not resigning because they say we can't do this or anything. They say that guy, we really can't work with him. He manages the board very badly. It's inefficient, and he basically cannot work with people.
Ron Darby, this is South Africa's and quite possibly Africa's largest fund manager. It manages the savings of millions of public
tenth
sector.
10th largest in the world.
10th largest in the world. That I did not know. Manages the savings of all our public servants. How damaging is this kind of conflict over its governance for the country, ultimately?
I mean, this is the last bastion. You know, like when I think of Dan Majila in that office of PIC, this is probably the premier banker of anything with regards to black business in the country. So this is the office that every single black businessman knocks on their door to get some source of funding. And you know, over how long has it been there? 13 years odd. This is like an examination of perhaps of his whole time then and what his actions there, and it almost drives the whole transformation agenda. Like it puts it on for me under a microscope, and clearly there has been some things that have gone wrong within the PIC, and we need, I mean, there needs to be a fresh change within the PIC, and I think Dan has held on for a long time. When he came into the position, he cancelled the CIO position, so he put himself as the funder of black business in the country, and that's where he sat for the past five odd years. All the pressure that have come to him is because he's, in my book, he's had to play the politics of the Zuma administration for the past 10 years odd, and now it's coming all to bear. And the only way to move on from this is for him to step back from that position as CEO of the PIC. He's stubborn, I guess. There's lots of, pretty much like I Prasa, the former CEO, Lucky Montana, didn't want to move away after 11 years there because he knew once he moved away, all these grimms would be shown, right? And I think pretty much in the same vein, I think Majid also fearful of walking away from the PIC, which is what he should be doing. We've used the PIC to batter private sector over transformation, over governance failures, and here is the one thing that was used to try and speed up governance and improve governance, improve transformation within corporate South Africa, having a governance catastrophe. So the only way forward for this is for Dan Machila,
for Dr. Dan, as he's known, to step away.
And as well for that, the chairmanship of the PIC to move away from politicians' hands. The whole idea of a deputy finance minister being the chairman of the PIC, that needs to change. And I think before Pravin Gordhan left, he said he was thinking of these ideas of moving that as a political appointment. I think that is something that really must happen after this, right? But it starts here with Majila. He's served his time. I mean, there's all accusations against him, whether they're right, whether they're wrong. He should step aside.
And Sikonati, I suppose, I mean, this is a fund manager which has held private sector companies to higher standards of governance, where its own governance is failing. I mean, is there the will to resolve this one?
I don't know if there's a will now. The whole thing we must remember, everybody will always be implicated one way or another. Tlantlanene appointed Daniel Machila back then. Tlantlanene was chairman of the PIC when Elias Masilela resigned with immediate effect, something that has never happened at the PIC. There's a notice period for executives of 6 months. Whatever happened that day, Elias Masilela resigned and left with immediate effect. Who was the chairman? Tlantlanen appointed, Tlantlanen appointed the next chief executive, and as Ron says, matched these really powerful positions, which served as some sort of a counterweight. The chief investment officer sat on the board at that point, together with the chief executive officer, and they were all accountable to the board. Now, there's just one person, a super powerful guy. Is there political will? It will probably, nobody will come out smelling of roses there. It's going to be difficult, but it has to be done for the sake of the nation.
And what has to be done as well is to clean out the rest of the state-owned enterprises. We've had this week news that the Treasury's report on Transnet has revealed really blatant capture, which is in the locomotive contract, which is really quite against the country's interests. Explicitly so.
I think the series of articles by Stefan Hofstadter in Business Day, and the lead article today, is astonishing. I mean, it's this report by Fundozi, which is just details how these things happened. You know, the Japanese provided 100 locomotives. They were locally assembled, manufactured. They were efficient. They were cost-effective. It was the cheapest tender. And somebody, Anuj Singh, intervened and shifted this tender away from them to a more expensive Chinese
tender. Less locally manufactured.
Not manufactured locally. And with billions in kickbacks built into the price. And it's just astonishing to see it, you know. And it's a very... I've read some of the original report material. It's all very dry. It's very, you know, invested. I mean, the detail is there. You know, phone calls, emails, communications, they have access to all of this, and they just lay it bare, and it's an astonishing picture.
Astonishing too, Sekunati, is what's happening at Eskom, where efforts to negotiate a wage deal have run into really vicious trade union pushback or worker pushback.
Now,
is this a bad sign for any other attempts to restructure Eskom?
It has not run to a trade union pushback. It's a pushback by thugs masquerading as employees of Eskom. And this is exactly what happens in a lawless society. We're talking about Anuj Singh now and all this corruption in the state-owned enterprises. With all of this evidence, there's not a single arrest. If the big guys can do it, the small guys can do it, and that's what they're doing at Eskom. If anybody can get away with stealing 15 billion rand of South Africans' money and there's all the evidence and nothing happens to them, I can get away with protecting my little job by making sure nobody will deliver coal to this power station where I work, if that means I must be denied an opportunity to work.
Ron, I mean, do you see the Eskom, what's been going on at Eskom with workers interfering with power stations? We've had load shedding this week. Do you think that is a symptom of a bigger state capture malaise, if you like?
Maybe a bit of that, but I also think, you know, when they put in the new board and they put in the new CEO and they put like, they, okay, this is the cleanup campaign, we're up and running, that's when the politicians will step back. When they first came with that 0%, which maybe now, on hindsight, 0% probably was a bad idea, okay, but the board decided, okay, we're going for what was 0%. That is when exactly the shareholders will step back and not got involved. I thought when Praveen got involved and said, now he'll negotiate and go to NUMSA himself, I think that empowered the unions themselves, the workers. It wasn't a question of we're dealing with our superior, like our bosses up above. This is like a political problem. And then I think that weakened that board quite significantly to avoid now, even if Phakamani comes out tomorrow and he's like bashing his hand against the table and taking a strong stance, the unions know, like, this is not about you, right? Your boss is above you, have already stepped in. So I think that was fundamentally the break that the ANC couldn't make. And that is what they should have. I mean, the whole 10 years of Zuma was about our politicians becoming executive chairman of these SOEs and playing this field where they should never have been in the very first place. If they were going to do this properly, that was in June, in February, when this happened, step back and leave it to Jabu Mabuza, leave it to that board to be sitting there dealing with these battles and charging people, whatever the case. But this is fundamentally how you have to break Eskom. It's not break Eskom per se, but You have to change the relations within ESCOM. ESCOM has become a minefield within Transnet, all of them. But our politicians still are busy. Like, yeah, that for me, the mistake was Praveen getting involved in it in any way near those negotiations. That was, for me, the biggest problem, because then it became a political play.
And Ray, what chance that the will is there to go ahead and do the restructuring that will surely be needed on a pretty grand scale to fix these state-owned enterprises? Is the political backing there?
I think the political will is not there. And that's the problem. And I think the unions know that it's not there. Because Ramaphosa's biggest constituency got him into power, drove his campaign, was the union movement. And he's weak within the ANC, can't afford to lose that constituency and have another enemy along with the Zuma camp up against him. So they know that there's a lack of political will and that he will not take on the unions right now. And so they're taking advantage of it.
Maybe after elections. But next door to us have been another set of elections, Ray. Have you been following the Zimbabwean elections?
Fascinating.
Free and fair? Fascinating that may be, but are they free and fair?
It's hard to say from here if it's free and fair, but it seems to have been very relaxed. Lack of incidents. I don't know, you know, the tweets from people saying it's all very chilled. And so what was fascinating for me was Robert Mugabe was back in the picture. There he was, the center of attention, on the eve of the election,
bitter man,
making this announcement that he's abandoning ZANU-PF. You know, the life force of Robert Mugabe is ZANU-PF for the MDC.
And yet people still, according to the results we've seen so far, people still didn't really give the MDC a majority.
Well, you know, it might have been a really great. Sort of terrible moment for the MDC because, you know...
You think it turned sentiment against them?
Well, ZANU-PF, I mean, Mnangagwa just jumped on it and issued a Facebook. Mm. You know, Facebook is the most brutal electoral tool available to a politician. Issued a Facebook video in which he said, vote for Chamisa and the Mugabes are back in the frame. Might have worked.
We've just got 1 minute left. Just your vote, was it free and fair?
I wasn't there, but it's quite amazing that... Nelson Chamisa, who declared victory before the election, has not been beaten up yet, so there has indeed been change.
Yeah.
Ron, free and fair?
As well, I haven't been there, but free and fair. But what Mugabe said there just went to show that Zimbabwe is all about him. You can't switch, your party kicks out, and then you turn on them, MDC. It tells you the past 20 years, it's been about one man. That to me was final, full stop.
That's all we have time for. Please join us again next week for another edition of Editing Aloud. Good night.